Till Death Do Us Part is a lighthearted and sometimes satirical true crime podcast where we present our dysfunctional married take on serious cases involving other dysfunctional relationships. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the 116th episode of Till Death Do Us Part.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Melissa. And right when we hit record, our neighbor across the street starts his pressure washer.
Yep. Oh, it just shut off.
Did it?
You probably won't hear it, so it's fine, but we can hear it.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Sensitive mics.
Why does he have a pressure washer going at 8 o'clock in the morning? Isn't that against the law?
No.
Ugh.
No. If I had a pressure washer, I don't know. I would just be pressure washing everything.
I'm actually surprised that we don't own a pressure washer.
I'm going to keep my eye out for one.
I wonder if they sell them on Poshmark.
I don't know. It's actually like really therapeutic.
Oh, I love watching people pressure wash things on Instagram.
Like driveways and sidewalks that have been dark for 75 years. And then some guy comes along and pressure washes it, or old brick.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, like old brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, we have already digressed significantly here, but anyway.
We have. Well, we are a true crime podcast where I tell my husband, Daniel, who's sitting across from me, I tell him stories of marriages that end in murder.
And I have ADD, so sometimes we just venture off into pressure washing stories.
And I have been recently diagnosed with ADHD, so that just about sums up our show.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we're just fairly normal-ish, kind of.
Are we?
Well,
I don't know.
Everyone has something. I don't know. But that's fine. And I'll probably stutter a lot because I'm tired, but I made... Let's see. 8 shots of espresso / mocha. But my daughter drank all of my chocolate syrup. So I had to use instant hot cocoa mix, which is not as favorable for a home espresso situation.
Oh.
But it actually came out pretty good with a little hint of artificial flavoring.
Which means we're having dairy in the morning. So I will have a lot of mouth noises.
Oh, it's just going to be chewing sounds from...
No, I edit those out, but it's going to take me hours.
That's fine.
Are you ready to start this?
Yes, let's go. Hurry up.
Once again, we are not doing factoids, but there is a reason why we are not doing factoids. I want to talk about a book.
I have one factoid.
Oh, God.
Do you want me to tell it?
Okay, go ahead.
Did you know that there are people that hike... Like, because they want to.
Why are you looking at me when you're saying
Because you don't like to do that. Anyway, so people that hike high altitudes, like go hike prep for major climbs and stuff like that. One of the things that they do take to help them with the high altitude is Viagra. It is an alternate use for its obvious use.
So and you're hiking with a boner?
No.
Can you say boner? On podcasts?
I don't know. Boner sounds like the name of a English bulldog. Because if I had a male English bulldog, I think that's what his name would be. Anyway. No, so that was a factoid. People do take it.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Years and years ago, there was an episode of Top Gear, I believe, the British show with Jeremy Clarkson and those other fellows.
Yes.
And they... dispersed Viagra to them all because they were operating some sort of vehicle challenge at like 10,000, 12,000 feet or 14,000 feet or something like that. And it's supposed to help with altitude sickness. It's a vasodilator, so it opens up your blood vessels and helps you absorb oxygen better so you're not out of breath.
So you're hiking with a boner. That seems very uncomfortable.
Only if you're turned on.
I thought it just automatically...
It doesn't automatically do that.
Oh. Okay. Well,
I'm not speaking from experience. I just have read how it actually functions. So if someone wants to share if they have done that, but I wouldn't know. Anyway, that's it. That's my only factoid. You're welcome.
Well, this is a perfect segue into talking about our friend.
Death.
A friend of the podcast, a Mr. McCracken Poston Jr.
Yep.
Who wrote a book called Zenith Man about one of my most favorite cases and love stories, which was Alvin and Virginia Ridley.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which episode number this was. Sorry. Maybe it was in the 70s. I don't know. But when I meet people out on the streets of Bakersfield.
Because you're always out on the streets of Bakersfield, like the song.
And I always ask, what is your favorite episode? 9 times out of 10, it's Alvin and Virginia.
There you go.
This love story, this case really resonated with a lot of people. And so McCracken, it was Alvin's defense attorney, and he just released a book about the case. And it's an in-depth look into the trial and what led to McCracken becoming Alvin's defense attorney. And it is beautifully written. And I learned so much about this case that really wasn't being reported on, because I read every piece of information, articles, everything I could get my hands on when it came to this case. But there's nothing like holding a book written by somebody who was there and somebody who experienced it firsthand.
And he was definitely the underdog defense attorney, because he was fighting against the mob mentality, I guess we could call it.
Or the biases of a small town.
But that's what I mean. So once everyone starts to believe something, then everyone kind of believes it because everyone believes it.
Absolutely.
And so he then has to go, okay, now I'm going to be the one to defend this guy against everyone's preconceived biased notions.
Yes. And what really led McCracken to being Alvin's defense attorney and being the only one really sticking up for him and for Virginia and for their marriage and the way that they chose to live their life. This was so beautiful. I cried through like probably half of it. And I loved getting to know Alvin and Virginia even more, and McCracken. I know most of you loved this case. Please go buy the book. It's called Zenith Man. And it's wonderful. And I do have a factoid today.
Oh, good.
Today officially.
What?
Is March 3rd.
Is it really?
Yes. Oh, and crap. Today is Alvin's birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Alvin.
Happy birthday.
I think he's 83.
I was going to say, how old is he? But then yeah. I put you on the spot.
And he still goes out to lunch all the time with Mr. McCracken.
That's
and
awesome.
And they're great friends. And I follow McCracken on Instagram. And there's been all these book signings with Alvin. And he's definitely become a celebrity in his little bubble. And it's been amazing for him. It just makes me sad that Virginia didn't get to see this.
Right.
See, and when I talk about him, I like get choked up.
Yeah, and not to hit the punchline of the book, but most likely if McCracken wasn't his defense attorney, Alvin would have gone to prison.
More than likely.
Yeah. That's really the bottom line here.
And if Alvin hadn't trusted him enough to mm-hmm. let him inside his home so that he could see Virginia's writings.
Right.
Where she shared her life.
Right.
And her love for her husband.
If you listen, beautiful. If you listen to the episode right away, I started already forming a biased opinion. Because you're feeding me information. So
right.
Based on the information, like most people, you've already convicted him.
Yes.
And then you throw the twist in and you're like, oh my gosh, I am such an a-hole. I was about to convict this guy.
Right. Just for being different.
Right. Because you start to assume things. You fill in the blanks with your own thoughts.
Yes.
So it's a good learning experience, I guess.
But Alvin and McCracken, thank you so much for kind of opening up people's eyes.
Yeah. So if you can, go take a peek at that book.
It's actually a wonderful book. I was going to read the last sentence written because it's just beautiful. And I listened to Megan and Sarah at It's Always the Husband, and they talked about the book as well.
Oh, good.
And they were talking about the last sentence, and it definitely left me in tears. Today, Alvin Ridley seems to enjoy his best life, basking in the warmth of a more understanding community. Last year, he started threatening to live to the age of 110 so that we will have 30 more years of having lunch together every week. And while it's something I never believed I would say, that would be a wonderful thing.
Aww. See, now I wish I lived in that town so that we could go, like, meet him and then take him out to lunch.
That'd be super meet him. Cool. We'll totally meet him.
I wonder if he likes a specific thing for lunch. I wonder if he's that kind of a guy.
I think he just had Chick-fil-A for the first time and loved it.
And now he's like, oh my God, I have something to live for. I never go to Chick-fil-A, but it's too expensive. Yeah. I can't afford it.
Actually, it's one of the cheaper options, it like In-N-Out. But yeah, it's a wonderful book. Please go support our friend, mm-hmm. McCracken. And I kind of wish I could do the case over again because there was so much more information that I did not get from those biased, opinionated articles that I was able to find.
But then how could you do the story already knowing what happens, though? Well, you did.
I knew what happened. Yeah. To get more in depth into the trial, it was fascinating. I think I've said fascinating 5 times. But if you can, I know times are a little tough right now, but if you really want to dig deeper into the case of Alvin and Virginia Ridley, go buy our friend's book. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. It's worth it. I promise. This would be a great book club book.
There you go.
It really would.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right, you ready for this next insane case?
I am, because I got to go back to work again.
How long do I have you for? 2 hours?
No, not even that. Like an hour and a half. What time is it? I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Daniel, you ready for my case?
Yes.
This is the case of Billy and Ann Woodward. And this is going to be a two-parter.
Oh, good.
Because there's a lot to get through.
Yep.
My information on this case came from the books, This Crazy Thing Called Love, written by Susan Brody, and the newest book on this case called Deliberate Cruelty, Truman Capote, The Millionaire's Wife, and The Murder of the Century by Roseanne Montillo. I looked up how to say that.
As you should.
Plus a few articles and some Wikipedia pages.
Oh, well, yeah. Then there's that. And you said Murder of the Century.
Murder of the Century.
Oh, boy.
Is what this is being referred to. At 2:07 a.m. on October 30th, 1955.
Okay, so that century. I was going to say, so which century? Because I don't know. This could be from 1623.
A frantic phone call came into the Oyster Bay 6 Exchange, which was an offshoot of the New York Telephone Company. Two telephone operators named Gladys Francis and Gertrude Gallagher were manning the lines. Gladys heard a hysterical woman on the line screaming and crying, and the only word that Gladys could make out was playhouse. Gertrude was listening in on the phone call and knew immediately that something was wrong and connected the line to the second precinct of the local police department. The caller was still frantic, and the officer was unable to get any information from her. Not a name, not an address, or where the call was actually originating from. The line remained open, and Gladys and Gertrude stayed on that line. Within minutes, another call was patched through to the police department. This time, it was a man by the name of Steve Smith. He worked on the 43 acres of the Woodward Mansion in the town of Oyster Bay Cove in Long Island's North Shore. Steve said that as he was walking the estate's grounds, he heard two loud pops spaced seconds apart. As Steve walked back across the tennis courts, he heard a woman screaming and calling for help. Steve ran up to the main house, which was also referred to as the playhouse, and was quickly standing in front of the locked front door. He noticed that the light was on in the hallway, and he could see the woman of the house, a Mrs. Ann Woodward, covered in blood and screaming for help. 40-year-old Ann yelled to Steve that something terrible has happened. Steve asked Ann to open the door, to which she told him that she did not have the key to unlock it. He ran back to his office and called the precinct. By 2:25 a.m., police were at the 12-room mansion on Berry Hill Road with Steve. They tried to kick in the front door, but it wouldn't budge. Instead, the right front window was broken, which just happened to be Anne's private bedroom. An officer crawled through the opening, entering the lush bedroom, and followed the sounds of Anne's screams and sobs.
Goodness. Okay. There's a lot happening.
So the front door was only open from the inside with a key.
Gotcha.
And Anne didn't have the key.
Okay. It was a well-built front door.
I think it really was.
Unlike today's houses.
Finding Anne sprawled over the body of a naked and bloodied man, lying on his back in a pool of blood. The side of his face and back of his head were blown apart. The man was 35-year-old Billy Woodward, Anne's husband of 12 years. The officer walked to the front door to unlock it, but without a key, it was impossible. He found his way to the back door and unlocked it, giving the other officers a way into the mansion. And more officers were called in. They were told to search the large estate, including the woods and inside the home, for a prowler. The prowler that had been keeping the upper-class Oyster Bay residents up at night and scared for their belongings. The chief of police, Russ Half, sat down with the new widower. Noticing that Anne was covered in blood, the red and sticky liquid caked her face, her hands, and her nightgown. Chief Half asked Anne if she saw the man who shot and killed Billy. Anne shook her head and screamed, "No, no." Taking a quieter approach, he calmly asked her if she had seen anything at all. Had she heard anything prior to the gunshots? Anne then slowly whispered, "I fired the shot. We both had guns. I thought it was the man that had been around here." Knowing that he had just heard a confession, Chief Half found a paper napkin and wrote Anne's statement down. He then called off the search of the estate for the prowler. He knew who the killer was, and he wasn't hiding in the woods. Anne, who was completely hysterical, still screaming and moaning uncontrollably, was then given 10 milligrams of Thorazine and put to bed. A nurse was brought in to monitor Anne and ended up filling 3 paper bags with all of Anne's prescription bottles found around the room and in her bathroom.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Now, why would you give 10 milligrams of Thorazine to a murder suspect?
Right. That's kind of odd.
Because then they can't be interviewed because they're basically in a zombie state.
This was the 50s. And so
it was.
They wanted like to make sure she's not hysterical.
And I think even in the 50s, they were giving people prescription cocaine.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. It's kind of
funny because it almost seems like back then, it was almost just a given, like, oh, she's really upset, so we're not going to bother her right now.
Mm.
Even though she just shot her husband.
She's hysterical. We're going to calm her down.
Yeah, we should give her time to calm down. So it's kind of funny, because now if that happened, they'd be like, no, we're going to drag you into
An interrogation room.
And you can just sit there and be hysterical. We're not going to give you any medication.
No, they would not give medication at that time. Mm-mm. There was a murder scene to process. But what was most shocking to everyone in that house was that the Woodward's 2 children and the house manager slept through all the commotion.
Oh, goodness. They had a house manager.
Mm-hmm.
We need a house manager.
Yes, we do.
Right now.
Yeah, they were in the upstairs area of the estate.
How do you sleep through a gunshot and all the screaming and the hysteria? And
the house manager said that she heard something, was woken up to a sound, but didn't know what it was. So she just stayed in bed until someone came and got her.
It is possible if you're in a deep sleep, if there's one gunshot, it would wake you up. But by the time you're aware, you sit there and listen and go, what the hell just woke me up?
Right. But Steve could hear Anne Woodward screaming across the grounds of the estate.
Yeah, so how do you just ignore that?
But the house manager didn't hear it from inside the house. So that's interesting to me.
Well, they're not getting paid when they're asleep. So that's true. Like, well, I'm off duty, so you handle your own screaming.
That's true.
I don't know.
The murder weapon was a double barrel Churchill Imperial Model side ejector shotgun.
As it should be.
And yes. This was found lying on the floor to the right of Anne's bedroom door. Near her door were the round paper remnants of the bullet cartridges. Mm-hmm. Billy's body was lying in the doorway to his private bedroom, which was located across the hall and a little further down from Anne's bedroom door. Looking into Billy's bedroom, it looked a bit off. It was sparsely furnished, and there were two single beds in the room. One had been slept in, and one was stripped of its bedding. There was a nightstand with a lamp, water bottle, ashtray, cigarettes, and eyeglasses. Near the bathroom door was a desk with a lamp, some paper and pens, and a flashlight, plus a shotgun and a semi-automatic pistol inside a black leather holster. So he was armed.
He was ready. This is the classic 50s stereotype, too. The two single beds, must have cigarettes, of course, ashtray, guns, you name it. And this is in a fancy house, yeah?
Yeah, it's a mansion.
Well, if they each have their own room, why two single beds in his room?
Because I think at one point they shared Anne's bedroom.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And at this point, they were now residing in two separate bedrooms. And this was only their weekend house.
Oh, of course it was. Mm-hmm. Right. Not like us. I get it. Nope. It's funny. I'm going to digress for 2 seconds. So my grandparents on my mother's side, they were very old school. And so I remember visiting them, and in their master bedroom, they had two single beds, exactly like you're describing it. Everything set up like that. They didn't have the ashtray. Although my grandfather did smoke at one point and then he gave it up, but that was very typical.
Yeah, like Lucy and Desi.
Absolutely.
I Love Lucy.
Yeah, so to stereotype it, I mean, that's how they were all the way up until he passed away. So the two single beds was very period correct like that.
My grandparents just had two separate rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least yours are still in the same room.
Yeah.
On a chair located across the room was a tuxedo laid out, along with a dress shirt, a black tie, and a pair of dress shoes. These were the clothes that Billy had been wearing earlier in the evening. Anne's room was a bit more decorated and cared for. She had a large bed filled with blankets and pillows. Found on her nightstands was a lamp, a radio, water bottle, cigarettes, and a flashlight. The second nightstand housed the telephone, another water bottle and glass, another radio, and a large pill box. On her dressing table sat all her cosmetics, perfumes, and bottles of prescription medication for Anne's migraines, anxiety, cramps, and overall pain. Anne was in a Thorazine haze till the late afternoon.
I bet.
Once she was stable, Anne began to talk about the events of the previous night. She and Billy had attended a party at the home of George and Edith Butler in honor of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. So is this kind of telling you their social standing?
Wowzers.
Now, their story in itself is interesting. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Do you know this story?
No.
Okay, this...
I have a question. What? Is there still a Duke and Duchess of Windsor?
I don't know.
I don't know. I didn't really expect you to answer. I'm just curious.
Probably.
They still have these titled folk.
They do still have these titles, but...
We should put the N in front of titled.
Yeah, I mean, entitled. I'm not English, so I don't really need to know that stuff. No. But sorry to our English listeners. I love your country. I really do.
Just not your entitled dukes and duchesses and folks like that.
Okay, so the Duke and Duchess of Windsor were Prince Edward, an American socialite and twice divorced, Bessie Wallace Simpson, who went by Wallace Simpson. Edward actually abdicated the throne after his father, King George V, died. And then he did that to be with, at the time who was married, Wallace Simpson.
Okay.
So they were having an affair.
Gotcha. Well, what else are you going to do?
Yeah,
They don't have to go to work every day.
His youngest brother eventually became King George VI, who was the father of Queen Elizabeth and grandfather to the current King Charles.
Wowzers. Okay.
After her second divorce was finalized, Edward married Wallace and they became the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
Okay.
Now, this was very scandalous during that time.
Oh, I bet.
Even more than the current Duke and Duchess of Sussex, which is Harry and Meghan Markle.
As a comparison.
As a comparison.
Fair enough.
Yes. They do compare the two, but this was even more of a scandal, but they were able to keep it more under wraps because of the time.
Sure.
We didn't have social media and we couldn't right. get everything at our fingertips, all the information. No. So I thought that was interesting. So Billy and Anne were at a party with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. I guess I just wanted to show their kind of social standings. They were friends with them.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
On the way to the dinner party, the couple had gotten into an argument. This one was over the purchase of a plane. Billy had purchased a plane.
You know, that's what's really preventing me from getting a plane is I just don't want to argue with you about it. Plus, where am I going to park it? And the neighbors would complain about trying to take off from our cul-de-sac. Yeah.
They arrived at the Baker's around 8:30 p.m., being some of the first guests to arrive. During the dinner party, the alcohol flowed and the conversation began to turn toward the Prowler. The recent robberies in the Woodwards neighborhood seemed to have been Billy and Anne's main concern that evening. Anne felt like she was being watched at the home. She also had been told by Billy that the man who took care of their property said that it appeared that the Prowler had spent the night of the 28th in their garage. He had found a window broken. He had also found cans of open food and footprints near the main entrance.
I have a question.
What?
If they can afford to discuss a plane purchase, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And they have a property manager. What do they call it? A house manager.
Property manager.
People, folk, all this stuff. Why don't they just have a security guard type situation? Someone just literally 24-hour round.
They did because there was a country club that was located right next to the house.
Of course there is.
Right. And they did have patrol of that area, but it was all wooded or surrounding it.
Mm.
So the Prowler could be in the woods and then at night.
Sure.
You know, kind of hide in areas and stuff.
Yeah, and I guess security camera footage wasn't as high tech as it is now back then.
I don't even think it existed.
I know, I'm joking. That's hilarious.
Oh, okay. All right, well, someone had been on their property.
Okay, all right.
Anne's devoted poodle named Sloppy had even woken her up in the middle of the night barking. And she insisted that this dog never barked.
If I had a poodle, you know what I would name it?
Oh, Lord.
Curly.
Billy and Anne left the party around 1 a.m.
Okay.
After returning home, Billy grabbed the pistol from the glove compartment of the car, and together he and Anne searched the house to make sure nothing was disturbed in the home. The couple went together down into the basement to a gun cabinet. Billy removed a shotgun and handed it to Anne, telling her to keep it next to her bed. And then Billy chose one for himself. They said goodnight to one another and walked to their separate bedrooms. Anne put the shotgun on the chair next to her bed and began her nightly routine, wiping away her makeup and changing into a nightgown and bed jacket. She brushed her teeth and swallowed a few Seconals and Thorazines.
Of course,
just right. a handful.
Right.
It all, I also read that she would drink 1 to 3 glasses of beer.
Oh,
to wash down.
There it is. I was going to say,
because that's the only way she could sleep.
I was going to say, and did she wash everything down with a nightcap of vodka or
she chose beer,
something like scotch? I don't know.
Oh, I God. Think she was on uppers all day and then she yes. had to take downers yeah. at night. But that was the day. And that then, was the time. And that was, wait, what am I trying to say? That was the era.
Era. Yeah.
That was the era.
I know. And it's funny because people go, well, back in the day, everyone was so skinny. It's not like today. It must be the food. It's the food. I'm like, okay, if I took pills all day, drank, and smoked, I would be half of my blobbish self I am now.
Right. But also, we didn't have the fast food that we have today. The restaurants weren't available as they are today.
Yeah.
It wasn't all processed food in a package.
Okay. But I can't afford fast food anymore because now it's, sorry, I digress again. But okay. So perfect. So you give a plethora of weapons, shotgun, to a woman that has just loaded herself down with pills and alcohol. That seems fine.
Well, it doesn't seem fine now, but it seems fine then.
I'm joking. Of
no,
course.
I know.
It's like, are you freaking kidding me? Why would you? Never mind.
Well, anyway. I think if Billy could take it back, he probably would have.
Well, yeah. Poor Billy.
Oh, yeah, Billy. Seriously. She pulled on her satin sleeping mask and settled under the covers for the night. Not long after, Sloppy started growling and Anne heard a crash. In her sleepy haze, Anne ripped off her mask and jumped out of bed, grabbing the shotgun from the chair, believing that the prowler was in their home. She raised the shotgun and walked towards her bedroom door.
In the dark.
In the dark.
That seems fine.
In a Thorazine and Seconal haze.
All right, I have a quick question, thought. It's not really a question. If the cops can't get into the house, they can't even beat the door down, how is this prowler getting in?
Good question.
Right? Am I missing something here? They obviously built the house really well. If they have 75 million guns in the house, that means they're obsessed with making sure they're secure. So they're checking every lock, window, probably obsessively. How did the prowler just wander in? I guess the prowler's in the house again.
Well, that's the question. Was there a prowler in the house? And I will right. eventually answer that in part two.
Oh, seriously? Oh, God. All right. Well, I'm just going to sit over here then and be quiet. Nope, probably not. Go ahead.
Okay. So she grabbed the shotgun, raised it, and walked towards her bedroom door. Anne slowly opened the door and peered down the hallway towards a large window at the end of the corridor. Anne heard the rustling of footsteps and saw a human shadow near Billy's door, illuminated by the moonlight coming through the window.
Fire!
She aimed and unloaded her shotgun.
Oh, God.
Anne then ran toward the figure.
I got him!
Which, I don't know if I would run toward the figure.
No.
That had collapsed on the ground and realized that the person she had shot was her nude husband, Billy.
Oh, he slept naked.
He did.
Just like me. Nope.
Realizing her mistake, she screamed. But instead of calling for help, she ran down to the basement and threw several shotgun shells back in the gun cabinet, telling the investigator that she was afraid if she kept the shells near her, she would be tempted to use them on herself. Anne ran back upstairs into the telephone that was located at the other end of the hallway. Anne said that for some reason, she could not dial the police department. Like, she probably forgot the number. I don't think it was 911 then.
No, it was like 17 numbers back then.
Yeah, but she could press zero and get the operator.
Dial the operator. Wow, that's crazy. So it didn't occur to her that if she heard something, that her husband, who also had 50 million guns in his room by his bedside table, wouldn't also come out. And
I don't think she was thinking very clearly.
No.
I mean, obviously.
Pill-induced haze.
And she was heightened. She was in a heightened anxiety state because all they had talked about at this dinner was the Prowler. Right. And people who were at this dinner said that she and Billy, that's all they talked about that night, was this Prowler. And Billy had even said, well, if I shoot and kill the Prowler, he's on my property, so I won't be arrested or charged.
So they're almost itching to find someone. They're almost hoping at that point.
I think so.
In a subconscious way, they're almost hoping that it happens so that they can do it.
Right. And they knew that he or someone had been on the property.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's scary, actually. Anne told the investigator that she had only fired in the direction of the noise. She only intended to scare the Prowler, not kill him. Okay. So she says she really didn't aim for the Prowler, but she just happened to shoot her husband in the face.
I wonder what the gun was loaded with. Was it a slug? Was it a...
It had a bunch of pellets.
Buckshot?
It was a buckshot.
But... Okay.
Because it had pellets.
Yeah.
Because they were all over the floor.
Birdshot's going to have tiny pellets, tiny BBs, so it'll pepper. And then buckshot's going to have bigger pellets or bigger BBs in it. So there's very few in it, but they're very big.
I feel like...
And then there's a slug.
I read it was a buckshot.
Okay.
It's in my brain going, buckshot, buckshot, buckshot.
I'm surprised the gun didn't blow out of her hand. Because that's a lot. It's 12 gauge.
Well, she was a really good hunter.
12, yeah. Okay, actually, so she knows what it's going to feel like when she squeezes the trigger. Yeah. All right.
She was actually really good with a gun, according to people that knew the couple.
Even with the pills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the question was, had Anne really mistaken Billy for the Prowler? And why did she just shoot at a figure without making sure that this was someone who was in the house to do them harm? Or had she shot Billy in the heat of the moment, using the Prowler as her excuse to kill her husband?
Yeah.
Had they been arguing? Was she over their marriage, over Billy, and just wanted him gone? It was no secret throughout the Woodwards family and social circles that the relationship between Billy and Anne was not good. There were rumors of infidelity on both sides. Talk of extreme fights that included domestic violence, and they had actually separated a couple times over the last 12 years of their marriage. So this wasn't a very functional marriage.
Wow.
Or relationship, to say the least.
Just goes to show you, you can't judge based on what the outside of the mansion looks like.
And you can't judge based on the photos that you see spread across newspapers.
Nope. I know it's funny because you see like Hollywood idiot pictures and you'll see a couple and they're just gorgeous, whatever, or not gorgeous, it doesn't matter. And then a month later you see some like headline and they're getting divorced and you're like, but they look so happy when they were at that dinner party or some awards thing. And it's like, they're acting.
They're professional liars.
Anyone can smile and hold hands. It doesn't mean they're enjoying it.
Kind of like us.
Exactly.
We just pretend to have a dysfunctional, functional relationship.
Right. I mean, I actually came from my other house so that we could do the podcast.
Your other bedroom.
Because we've already separated.
William Woodward Jr., also known as Billy, and Anne Eden met while she was performing on stage at a club in New York City called Fifi's Monte Carlo in the spring of 1941. Anne was wearing a white bathing suit, black fishnet stockings with bunny ears and a cottontail sewn onto her booty.
Oh, can you dress up like that one of these days?
I sure can.
That would be hilarious.
She was part of a trio that called themselves the Bunny Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this was before Playboy.
I was going to say maybe this was the beginning. Well, how old would Hugh Hefner have been then?
82.
Even back then?
Yeah,
in the 40s.
Anne worked the midnight to 3 a.m. shift, dancing two shows per night and mingling with the male patrons the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The men would buy them drinks and give the ladies money and gifts if they were thoroughly entertained.
Oh.
And Ann Eden was very entertaining. Billy and a friend walked into the club at 2:45 a.m. for a drink, spying Ann preparing for her last performance of the evening. He was immediately intrigued. Now, Ann is beautiful, just beautiful, curvy. This girl had it going on and she knew it. When Ann spotted Billy, she immediately recognized him from a picture she had been shown only days before. Billy's father, William Woodward Sr., had shown Ann a photograph of his 22-year-old son in hopes that the 27-year-old Ann would seduce him and show him the ways of satisfying a woman.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So she's older than him.
She's 5 years older than him.
Okay. Maybe you told me before. I didn't really.
At the time of his death, Billy was 35 and Ann was 40.
Gotcha. Okay.
William was convinced that his son was still a virgin or possibly gay.
Oh.
There were lots of rumors surrounding Billy.
Okay.
For his entire life, actually.
Okay. So the dad was like, all right, I got to find a hot chick for you, and then that'll steer you straight, so to speak.
Right. The things they used to do in the past.
Right.
That just made things horrifically.
Clearly worked.
Ugh. Yeah. He wanted Anne to use her seductive ways to awaken the playboy within Billy.
Mm.
William knew Anne had a power over the opposite sex because he had been privy to those sexual moves. For Anne had been William's mistress for months before her encounter with younger Billy. I see here.
Hold on. I'm letting that all sink in. Wait, did you just say she was his dad's miss?
Yes.
I caught that.
That's exactly right. What I said. She was boning the dad.
That would be awkward for me and my dad right now. I got to be honest with you.
Oh my gosh, your dad listens. You can't say stuff like that.
Why not? I'm just saying, Bob. That would be odd if he's like, hey, Daniel, so I got this thing on the side.
No, they didn't.
Oh,
Billy didn't know that Anne was his dad's mistress.
That's even worse. So he's sending his mistress to go like try and seduce his son.
Yeah, and teach him how to make love to a woman.
Lord have mercy.
Okay, let me finish.
All right,
okay.
I'll stop. You finish.
At 65 years old, William Woodward Sr. was bored and unsatisfied in his life and in his marriage. He had married Billy's mother, Elsie, in 1904, and after 38 years of marriage and 5 children, he was looking for a little excitement.
I bet.
He found that excitement after seeing Anne perform on stage at the Fifi Monte Carlo. He invited her to his table for a drink and was immediately mesmerized by the charming and beautiful Anne, as the two began a secret relationship soon after. Anne knew the prominent member of the Woodward banking family was married and would never leave his wife. Anne settled for the attention William gave her, plus the extra money and gifts. Yeah. After a couple of months, William had to break off the affair because they were getting too serious. But William still wanted Anne around, so he asked her if she would be interested in dating his son for a bit, kind of help Billy out.
Of course,
she agreed. And if she couldn't have the dad, she could definitely have the son. After Anne's performance, Billy invited the 27-year-old Anne to his table for a drink. He was immediately smitten with the curvaceous blonde. Anne exuded sex. She had a way of looking at a man while lighting a cigarette that made them swoon. I mean, are you envisioning this woman?
Yeah.
She like knew how to maneuver her body to look sexy and to draw men to her.
Right.
She should have written a book, actually.
Yeah.
How to seduce men. And Anne really liked Billy. This wasn't like a pity kind of thing. She actually really liked him right away. Their meeting was a classic seduction scene, and it worked. Soon, Billy was in Anne's bed, and he became her prized student. The couple were soon in lust and began seeing one another exclusively. Friends and family understood the draw, but were sure Billy, the young man raised in one of the richest families within the United States, the prince of the New York banking family, who exuded wealth and good breeding, would soon tire of the poor farm girl from Kansas with no social standing, who was defiant, loud, and dressed in clothing that was two sizes too small. But that never happened. He never tired of her. Huh. And the more people disapproved of his relationship with Anne, the more Billy lusted after her. She was different from all the other perfectly bred and boring women he was being pushed towards. Anne was fun.
Yeah.
This was the first time Billy was making his own decision, not letting the Woodward family choose his bride.
But didn't the dad kind of choose her for him?
He chose her to have fun with Billy and to teach him how to be with a woman so that he could move on to one of these perfectly bred women and be able to satisfy them and have a relatively good marriage.
Okay. All right.
Or so that he could learn what to do with his mistresses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
Anne Eden was born Angeline Cromwell. She came to New York at 20 years old in an old used car she had purchased on her own. She had emptied her savings, filled the car with all her belongings, and entered the city with dreams of getting into show business through modeling.
So she knew she was gorgeous and sexy, so she used that to her advantage.
Yes, because everyone told her she was.
Yeah.
And she was.
Yeah.
Anne established a new identity, going by Anne Eden. Anne was told that she was too curvy to actually model, but she did land jobs in print work. She also won bit parts in off-Broadway shows and won leading roles in popular radio productions. Anne was making it on her own. But in 1941, Anne's mother became ill. She was diagnosed with a lung disease, which was a rare form of tuberculosis usually found in cattle.
Ugh.
It was awful. Anne moved her to a lung hospital in New York City, and the treatments drained Anne's savings. Mm. She needed to find a job where she only needed to work a few hours every night, leaving her time to sit with her mother at the hospital during the day. That's when she was hired at the Fifi Monte Carlo. It was good pay. Anne was also frequented by Broadway and Hollywood producers. Anne shined in her new job, becoming the crowd favorite. In March of 1941, Anne's mother died, but she stayed on at Fifi's and then soon met William Sr. On August 15th, 1942, after the couple announced their engagement, Billy drove Anne to the Saratoga racetrack to introduce his future bride to the entire Woodward family. Elsie, Billy's mother, immediately disliked Anne. She was bold, loud, and openly smoked and drank in excess. William Sr. just seemed incredibly uncomfortable.
I bet.
During the horse race, Anne openly cheered. Billy's four older sisters tried to shush her, but Anne just kept going. And Billy loved it.
So that wasn't done. The women couldn't cheer for horses?
No, and they shouldn't drink and smoke.
No.
In excess. But she was she was having a good time. And she didn't care. She didn't care what they thought of her at that time.
Uh-huh.
After the meeting, Elsie became frightened of what Billy's relationship would do to this family's social standing, believing Anne was a gold digger and only after Billy's $10 million trust.
Wait.
Yeah.
This would have been
1940.
Circus 40s.
Uh-huh. $10 million.
Pre-war.
Yeah.
Gosh.
That's like $50 million now.
That is a significant amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine? It sounds wonderful.
Well.
Well, Elsie hired a private investigator, but nothing was really found out that was shocking or that she could use to sway Billy from Anne. For the first time, Billy was being rebellious, and he loved it.
So the private investigator did not uncover the fact that her husband had also had Anne.
No, because they were only in an affair for a couple months.
Okay.
And did a good job hiding it, I guess. So.
Well, they didn't take pictures and post it.
Not really. Yeah. Not then. Yeah. By the end of 1942, World War II was in full swing, and Billy decided to enlist in the United States Navy, many say as a way to impress his dad, William Sr. Billy left for Washington State in December, leaving Anne in New York City, but they were engaged. In fear of being shipped off, Billy and Anne were married in March of 1943.
Would that prevent you from being shipped off?
No, but if something happened to him while he was gone, she would get all the benefits of being married to him.
I thought you were going to say that he used his influence so that they did not send him to a frontline situation.
No, he wanted to impress his dad, so he joined as just
he enlisted as a serviceman. Oh, goodness.
A serviceman, yeah.
Wow, okay.
By the end of that year, Anne was pregnant, and Billy had been deployed. By the birth of their first son in July of 1944, Billy was back home in New York City. He had been aboard the USS Liscom carrier when it was attacked by a Japanese submarine. The ship sank, and Billy was one of only 272 crew members who survived. Over 550 men lost their lives in that attack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. After returning home, Billy changed. He had a new zest for life and didn't seem like he wanted to be a settled down family man. He now wanted the freedom to be a sort of playboy.
Well, because he got a second chance on life.
He did.
He's like, I'm not wasting this. I'm going to go have some fun.
He worked at his father's bank during the day and went out around the town at night, leaving Anne at home, which just happened to be on the top floor of his parents' New York City home. They had turned it into like an apartment for them. But Anne had changed too. Trying to become a woman of high social standing, she began taking etiquette classes, voice lessons, even losing her Kansas accent. She learned how to arrange flowers and set a proper dinner table, even started dressing more modestly. I think she became what Billy wasn't attracted to in the first place. So he went out every night to find some sort of excitement.
So he didn't want what she was turning into. He wanted what she was originally.
Yes, but she felt like she needed to change into a woman who could enter these social settings.
The stereotypical influential part of society, upper class society.
Right.
She wanted to fit that mold.
She just wanted to fit in.
Right.
But Billy fell in love with her or was attracted to her because she didn't fit in.
Right.
So they were both becoming something that the other wasn't really into.
Mm-hmm.
Billy was bored, and Anne had seemingly transformed herself into his mother.
Oh, that's
yeah, that's lovely.
That's a turn on.
In January of 1948, Anne gave birth to the couple's second son, and by that summer, the couple had moved their new family into a five-story brownstone on East 73rd Street in Manhattan. I'm sure it's beautiful home.
I'm guessing that's nice.
In photos around this time, they still looked like the perfect upper class couple, beautiful and smiling. They were always in the newspaper, so they always had to look perfectly put together and in love. But this was also the time that the couple began to fight, verbally and physically fight. And Billy began an affair with a married woman of high social standing. And this was not a secret affair. They were out and about in town. In September of that year, the couple separated, and by December, Billy had asked Anne to officially divorce him, offering Anne $2 million.
Take it.
But soon, Billy discovered that Anne had also been having an affair, and he took back the $2 million offer.
Dang it.
This kind of turned Billy on, actually, that she had been having an affair. And so the two of them began having a secret affair with each other.
What? Okay, sure.
Does that make sense?
No.
Like they're having an affair and sleeping with other people.
Right.
Which is then turns them both on. And then they start having an affair on these other people with each other.
So they both know each other are sleeping with others.
Right.
So then they go, well, for excitement, let's sleep with each other so that we're cheating on each other's cheats.
Something like that. Yeah.
No, it makes sense. I get it.
Soon the couple had called off their divorce, but they agreed to an open relationship.
Ah.
Especially from Billy's side. But the fighting didn't stop, and they never tried to hide it anymore either. The staff saw some pretty intense interactions between the couple, like punching, grabbing and ripping of clothes, and scratching. And they were both doing it to each other.
Oh, so it's foreplay.
Well, like Billy would have black eyes. She would have bruises all over her body. He would have scratches on his neck. Like they physically got into it. And then the next day, they would just act like nothing happened.
Well, at least the kids were happy.
I can't imagine.
At least the kids were brought up well. That's fine.
They were brought up by help. Is what it sounds like. Yeah. In September of 1953, William Woodward Sr. died at the ripe old age of 77. Billy became the sole inheritor of his father's horse farm called Bel Air Stud and Farm. I love that name. This did nothing to help the Woodwards' marriage. If anything, the money made the relationship even more strained. The couple continued fighting, even out in public. People saw them going at it. In public. And there seemed to be a pattern. They would have an affair, have a knockdown, drag-out fight, and then they would sleep together and then start the dysfunction all over again. It was a toxic and volatile marriage.
Seems fine.
Seems very functional. And according to friends and family members, Billy had grown tired of the back and forth and had finally asked Anne for a divorce. Within the months leading up to his death. But according to Billy's will, all his money went into a trust. Billy was worth more to Anne alive than dead.
Okay.
After Anne gave her initial statement about the shooting of Billy, her personal doctor arrived at the mansion. Believing that she was on the verge of a nervous breakdown, Anne's doctor sent her to Doctors Hospital on the Upper East Side of New York City because she was in a fragile state.
Uh-huh, uh-huh,
uh-huh. By the next day, the shooting death of Billy Woodward by his socialite wife had made local and national newspapers. Reporters were camped out at the mansion and in front of the hospital, all waiting for an interview or picture of Anne. Billy's funeral was held November 2nd at St. James Church, located in the city, and then buried at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Anne was unable to attend, but did send flowers that were displayed on Billy's casket. To Edith, they were tacky, but what would people say if her son's widow had not sent flowers?
Right.
So she had to put them on the casket. After taking a closer look at the crime scene findings and the case, Elsie's high-powered attorneys told her that the case was actually very weak. If they pushed too hard to convict Anne for Billy's murder, investigators would have to dig deep into the Woodward marriage, and Billy's indiscretions would be splashed all over the front of the newspapers, which would end up being an embarrassment to the Woodward name. Because they would find former lovers.
Right.
And she was actually afraid that they would find former male lovers.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Plus, They knew well enough that Anne's defense team would use the common law rule that she was legally allowed to defend herself if someone entered her house with the intent to do harm. In other words, she could shoot and kill an intruder, shooting the person she believed to be the prowler.
Yep.
A press conference was held on November 4th. Police Chief Pinnell said that the district attorney had decided to submit all the evidence to a grand jury later in the month in Nassau County, saying, quote unquote, if the grand jury dismisses the shooting as an accident, we won't press charges. After hearing the press conference, Elsie decided she would meet with her daughter-in-law at the hospital. There were some things needed to be said between the two most important women in Billy's life, the one who gave him life and the one who took it. And I'm going to end part one there.
That's had to have been an interesting conversation.
We will get into that at the beginning of part two. In part two, I'll be telling you about the aftermath of the shooting, the possible trial, the actual prowler, and what Truman Capote has to do with this case.
Oh.
If you are a youngin, I'll explain who Truman Capote is. So we'll be back with the finale next week.
Fun.
And I will also tell you how this case is connected to two other cases that I've told you about on this podcast.
Really?
Yes. Two other people this is connected to.
6 degrees.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that before?
I've never heard that before.
Instead of 6 degrees of separation, no, it's that. 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
What's the Kevin Bacon angle?
Anyone can lead to Kevin Bacon in 6 degrees.
Six
is what they say.
Oh.
Yeah, six people.
Gotcha.
You've never heard that before?
No, but that's fair, I suppose.
I think so. I mean, yeah. Kevin Bacon's a rock star.
Yeah, and who doesn't like bacon? I mean.
I love bacon.
Even people that claim they are vegans probably secretly eat bacon.
Probably.
I'm just saying, you know, I don't expect anyone to admit it, but I bet you do.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed part one. I think this is probably my new favorite case that I've researched. So Wowzers. I'm super excited to tell you the rest of it.
All right. Fun.
Do you have any questions, darling?
No, I got to go to work in 10 minutes.
All right. Well, be careful.
For marriage is a life sentence.
And divorce is always the better option.
Yep.
See ya.
Bye.